You're listening to
Think!
Think, from CGSR 88.5 FM. Think presents lectures, panel discussions, and interviews with noteworthy individuals about some of the most crucial issues facing the world today.
Good morning, and welcome to Think on CJSR. I'm Warren Mulvey. On today's show, we present former Canadian Prime Minister and elder statesman Joe Clark speaking about his new book, How We Lead, Canada in a Century of Change.
Now, I would argue that today, after that wall has come down, that physical wall came down, after the force of ideology receded, the major source of conflict now is differences among cultures, differences among faiths, differences which, if approached positively, could lead to cooperation, differences if ignored or exacerbated, could lead to conflict.
The Right Honorable Charles Joseph Clark served as Canada's 16th Prime Minister from June 4, 1979, to March 3, 1980. He is the youngest prime minister in Canadian history, being sworn in the day before his 40th birthday. He served in a variety of roles afterward, most notably as a member of Brian Mulroney's cabinet and as the penultimate leader of the Federal Progressive Conservative Party before its dissolution. He was born in High River, Alberta, and earned bachelor's and master's degrees in political science at the University of Alberta. After his second retirement from politics in 2003, Clark has served as vice chairman and member of the Global Leadership Foundation and on the International Advisory Board of Governors of the Center for International Governance Innovation. He has also held academic positions at McGill University and American University, Washington, D.C. Clark has been awarded the Queen Elizabeth II Silver Jubilee Medal, the 125th Anniversary of the Confederation of Canada Medal, and the Queen Elizabeth II Golden Jubilee Medal. He is also a member of the Alberta Order of Excellence and a Companion of the Order of Canada. And now, we present to you Joe Clark speaking about his book, How We Lead, Canada in a Century of Change, from Edmonton City Hall on November 27, 2013. After the lecture, we will present CJSR News Director Matt Hirji's interview with Joe Clark about his book. Please enjoy.
I'm going to start my remarks today with a story that I will not pretend is not apocryphal, but it carries a meaning, I think. I had the opportunity to lead the Canadian delegation to the Uruguay round of the multilateral trade negotiations a long time ago. And like all important diplomatic undertakings, this conference began with a cocktail party. And there was a particular minister, I won't name the country or identify the gender, who'd been getting ready for this cocktail party all day and was in pretty good shape by the time things were to begin. He sort of hove into the room just as the music went up and the lights went down. And he saw over in the corner what he described as a vision in red. And he went over and he asked that vision in red, "Will you dance with me?" And that person replied, "No." And for three reasons. First, I don't dance. Second, that music is our national anthem. And third, I am the Archbishop of Montevideo. Now, I tell that story to make the point that it is important to know where you are and what exactly it is you're facing. I'm going to speak very briefly about Canadian history in foreign policy, but largely because history should be a guide to the future. At the end of the Second World War, Canada was one of the few Allied countries that had not been physically deeply damaged. Other countries, other of our allies, were literally in rubble. We had capacity. The Americans did. We did. Some other countries did. That was one of the credentials that we brought to the construction of the post-war world. But another was that our valor on the battlefield had won us respect among our allies and literally across the informed world. It had built a trust in Canada that had perhaps been inherent before, but became quite clear then in this time of facing a world that was quite new. In addition to that, we had capacities for conciliation that even then were evident in the Canadian character, because we were even then less diverse than today, but a very diverse society then, making diversity work. And we had demonstrated even then the capacity to draw very able people to what was then our foreign service, and they in their own service, as ambassadors, many of them overseas during the war, had impressed others with their capacity to seek to understand other societies and to use that knowledge to conciliate changes that might be made going forward. And finally, we were a bridge between two worlds. We were a bridge between Europe and on the other hand, the effervescent, powerful, arising United States of America. That bridge role, just parenthetically, has been a very important part of the role that Canada has played over the years. That was then. Some of the things that flowed from that are well known. People know the role that Canada played in the creation of peacekeeping, Lester Pearson and General E.L. M. Burns. They know that John Humphreys was the author of the signal document of the United Nations. They perhaps do not know that in terms of the World Trade Organization, which made it possible for there to be rules which governed how commerce was pursued among nations, the first working group to study what kind of an organization might be put in place was led by, deliberately chosen, a Canadian diplomat from Vancouver. What is not so well known is that when the British Empire, after the Second World War, became the British Commonwealth, the person who was one of the principal architects was the then Foreign Minister of Canada, Louis Saint-Laurent, a distinguished French-Canadian lawyer from Quebec City. It is perhaps more known that when the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was established, there were, in effect, three wise men who designed the organization, one of whom was a Canadian, Lester Pearson. Those traditions of being conciliators, of playing above our weight, of being trusted, of putting that trust to work, carried Canada through a number of the challenges that we and the world have faced over the intervening several decades. They helped inform Mr. Diefenbaker's initiative to lead to the, I was going to say expulsion, that's not quite the accurate word, of South Africa. Because in 1960, when he took that position, he was careful to say, there will be a light in the window for you to return when apartheid is gone. It inspired the various overtures to China, whether they were the trade overtures of the Diefenbaker government with grain, or whether they were the diplomatic overtures of the Trudeau government with formal diplomatic recognition. They inspired Flora Macdonald when she and other and Parliament, really, to give them credit, led the world in response to the refugees, the boat people cast adrift to die in the China Sea in the late 1970s and 80s. They inspired the invitation to Canada to become a member of the Group of Seven, an economic group that became, in effect, the political cockpit of the world. They inspired the decision by Canada. Those of you who know me as a partisan will realize how difficult it is for me to say what I'm going to say next, because it involves praise of Lloyd Axworthy. Inspired Canada when Mr. Axworthy was the foreign minister to take the lead working with NGOs to transform a cause which had been the elimination of landmines into a treaty, which made that a legal reality and an enforceable practice. That tradition lasted for six decades under different governments, liberal and progressive conservative governments. I talked briefly of the new world that Canada faced in post-1945. I do that because we are facing a new world now. And it has been, I would argue, created by a number of factors, but principally two. Both of those, had to do with the collapse of walls. One of those walls was a wall we knew was there, a physical wall, the Berlin Wall, which came down, and its coming down really marked the end of the Cold War. And what is significant about the Cold War is that so long as it was dominant, the principal source and dominant guiding force of conflict in the world was ideology, a presumed ideologic difference between the Soviet Union and its allies and the West. I would argue that today, after that wall has come down, that physical wall came down, after the force of ideology receded, the major source of conflict now is differences among cultures, differences among faiths, differences which, if approached positively, could lead to cooperation. Differences, if ignored or exacerbated, could lead to conflict. The other wall that came down was one we didn't know was there. And it was the wall expressed by the development on a large scale of the internet, which broke down walls of distance and ignorance and people who did not know that there were others elsewhere in the world, elsewhere in their own community, who thought as they thought. It transformed the world in many ways as much as battles of 1945 did. That internet had a couple of consequences. I'll just mention three. One has to do with citizens. Citizens who, even in the most robust of democracies, often feel they have no capacity to influence events at all. But if we feel that in robust democracies, think of being a citizen of an Arab state before the Arab Spring. I deal a lot with questions of governance in the developing world. And if you had posed a question 10 years ago, what is the region where authoritarian regimes are least likely, to lose their grip, people would say the Middle East will be the region where that will happen last. And indeed, it happened first, or near first. There were precursors of that in Eastern Europe. It happened there in part because the internet was such a transformation to people who thought that they were the only voice and concern about their particular regimes. That was one change, the empowerment of individuals. Individuals, citizens, cannot be kept out in the way they were before. And attempts to keep them out will backfire. They will become, in any society, a source of either discord or disinterest, both of which are fatal, can be fatal to societies. The second thing that happened is that, as a consequence, in large measure, of the economic growth after the end of the Berlin Wall, there has been a growth in the power of a number of states that, on the basis of their economic strength, were marginal before. There have been great improvements in terms of dealing with poverty, in terms of building economies in countries that used to be called developing economies and are now called emerging economies, because they are, in fact, emerging in this new world. And what that means is that because power is multiple, it has multiple sources, that means that these countries, which were once interesting, exotic, off to the side, are now highly competitive and are going to be leaders in the world economy. We used to live in a world of superpowers. There won't be superpowers again. Nations like the United States of America will remain very strong. China will remain very strong. But there's not going to be the kind of domination by a single state that there was in previous times. In fact, you have a multitude of states, all of now who have powers, who are determined to follow ways of their own. Many cases that creates much more difficulty in terms of finding consensus, but it means that the consensus that is found, when it is found, is more genuine. It is not as likely to be imposed. It's likely to come, but it certainly changes the dynamic of international affairs. And the third development, the one that to which we pay too little attention, has been the development of non-state actors. There was a time, a long time, when the only agents that mattered in international affairs were nation states. And nation states, of course, matter now, not least because they are the only entities who can change the rules. They write the treaties. They adopt the laws. They promulgate regulations as to how the world operates. But there is now suddenly this swarm of non-state actors, of agencies that are not states but have great influence. I use two examples far too often, but example one, Greenpeace has more influence on public policy than most national governments do. It's changed thinking more than most national governments do. The Gates Foundation is more innovative than most national governments are. There is this wide range of agencies which are making remarkable changes. We see them. I see them, anyone involved in development sees them internationally, whether they are formal organizations like Oxfam or Amnesty or the Red Cross or World Vision, or whether they are faith groups who are out perhaps going on a narrow mission to a place, but once they get into a place, they learn they have competences that are required and they become community builders beyond their faith. These are now very important forces in the world. This change, these two walls that came down, have created a new world, but they also cause a country like Canada to ask ourselves, in this new world, what are our assets? How can we be most effective in replicating in this new world the kind of accomplishment we were able to achieve or contribute to in the former new world? I want to mention just three of them. Diversity is far more critical, a far more decisive factor. Largely cultural diversity is a far more critical factor than it was before. And without exaggerating our strengths, without denying our limitations and failures, we are better at managing diversity, and more importantly, we are better at respecting the roots of diversity than any other country in the world. That's part of the reason that we have been successful in negotiation in the past and successful as intermediaries. It's certainly a qualification for the future. But it's not simply that we're good at it. We have earned a reputation for being good at it. So when people are in need of help, they tend to come to Canadians to offer that kind of help. That question of dealing with diversity is a critically important factor. The second factor is that we are, because of our history and our conduct, we are by and large trusted by both the wealthy and the developing countries. We're a member of the G7. We're the only member of the G8 now. We're the only member of the G8 whose only history with colonialism was that we were a colony. We're not an imperial power, never have been. We're not a colonial power, never have been. We have those lines open to the developing world. And yet we retain our place at the center of developed countries when we exercise those powers. And a third asset, it seems to me, really marries the two, but it has to do with our skill and our reputation as negotiators, as mediators, and our deep commitment to multilateral organizations. This isn't a question of ideology or belief for us. We've known from the very beginning that with all of our assets, all of our strength, we could do nothing alone. We had to work with others. We have to be part of a multilateral system. And because it's essential to us, and we think essential to the world, we have historically tried our best to make those multilateral systems work. I think that there are essentially, this is a great simplification, four elements to Canadian international presence, policy, and potential. One, obviously, is economic. We can be nothing if we do not have a strong economy. Not only because there are other countries that are growing, but also that is the only means by which we can turn protest into performance. We can have opinions on all sorts of things, but you have to have a capacity to turn that opinion into some kind of reality. And at the end of the day, you need a strong and growing economy to do that. The second quality is a military quality. Because there will be in the future, values that are important to us and that do require defense by force, and because we are a huge country that during the Cold War lay on the fight path, I'm not saying flight path, I'm saying fight path, between the then Soviet Union and Washington and the United States, and now is a country whose size will always be of interest to others, but whose resources, not least in our north, are of particular interest to others. We need capacities to defend ourselves and join in common defenses. So military capacity is a second. The third is diplomacy. We have made many of the strides we've made as an international country in the last six decades because we have practiced very skilled diplomacy. And it remains. I can say this as someone who was never a trained diplomat. I was simply the boss of very good trained diplomats. And I was in a position, as perhaps no one else could be, to judge exactly how strong our tradition and our serving officers in international diplomacy were. And the fourth component was our sympathy to and active involvement in the poorer world, an involvement expressed as international development. And we were very sincere about that, and we were innovators. It was Canadians who began the heavy focus upon the role of women in development. It was Canadians who developed the heavy focus upon the importance of forestry internationally. We have had that role for a long time, and it is part of our trademark. So there are four: economics, military, diplomacy, development. And my concern, and let me just, to be as someone who I shouldn't quote once used to say, to be perfectly clear. I absolutely believe that economic and military strength are essential to the Canadian future. There could be no question about that. The point is, they are not enough alone. Let me go back. I'd referred to our membership in the G7. We were invited to become a member of the Group of Seven, principally on economic grounds, but it became that Group of Seven, the directing point, for better or for worse, of international policy. Why were we invited to be the member of the G7? Because at that time, we had the seventh largest economy in the world. We are never again going to have the seventh largest economy in the world. And if in the past we have counted upon our economic clout to open other doors for us, that quality is shared by others. It is no longer as distinguishing an asset as it was before. It's important, but it is not enough alone. Another major change in this new era, speaking to our military capacity, is that whatever one thinks of a particular conflict, the evidence is clear that wars today are harder to win than they were before. Indeed, there's been a fundamental recognition of this in the Canadian Defense Forces themselves, who in the latter years in Afghanistan began to place more and more attention on training their members to become effective in what used to be called peace building. So military engagement no longer involves simply war fighting. It also involves this capacity for peace building. And interestingly, we have trained a number of very able people on the hard ground of Afghanistan to become skilled in these matters. That's a very particular asset, and there's a legitimate question as to whether those functions should be carried out in a military context or in some other. But nonetheless, that asset is there, and the reality is there, that wars are harder to win, and that our economic prowess will open fewer doors for us than it did in the past. My concern about Canadian policy today, and I'm not going to dwell on it at length, Canada has plenty of cards to play in international affairs. The risk is, if we focus narrowly on economics and on the military, we will be playing with only half our deck, and we will not be as effective as we could be or we should be. Conciliation today and conciliation in the future is going to be far more essential, not least because wars can't be won, not least because there is a need to anticipate these conflicts before they arise and to take actions that can mitigate them. In terms of the multitude of powers, new states with power, new organizations with power that are not states, that means that the table at which decisions are going to be taken is going to be much larger, much more various, much more essential, because a critical aspect is to draw many of these various agencies to the same table. So if they're going to say no, they at least have to say no to somebody they can see across the table. And being around a table, I know, you know, all of us who have been involved in any kind of negotiation anywhere, including in our families, realize that being around the table with the person who disagrees is far more effective than being elsewhere. So conciliation is going to be a very critical matter. The second chapter of the book you're all going to rush out to buy and read is entitled Leading from Beside. It's a phrase that I think I can claim to have coined, but I'll tell you its origins. Some of you may remember that in the Libyan, as Libya was coming undone, and there was a need, a felt need for some international intervention, both France and Britain offered to lead that intervention because they thought the Americans, who normally lead these things by rote, were preoccupied elsewhere. The Americans were pleased about that and said so. But unfortunately, some poor person in the White House described that as America leading from behind. Well, you can imagine how that went over with the Senate and Congress of the United States. And the phrase was very quickly disavowed. But if you're not leading from behind, and if we live in a world where one state can't always lead from in front, then it becomes more and more necessary that we share the capacities of leadership, that we lead from beside. And in effect, that's what Canada has done historically. One of the interesting things about our role in international negotiation is that we did not need to be at the head of the table. What was important to us was not who sat at the head. It was what the table did, what got accomplished there. And in a world where tables are going to be larger, the parties are going to be more complex, a country that respects diversity, that has a reputation for respecting others, is going to have a larger and larger and more influential role if we decide to exercise it.
We love wisdom. You're listening to Think on CJSR 88.5 FM. I'm Warren Mulvey. On today's show, former Canadian Prime Minister and elder statesman Joe Clark speaks about his new book, How We Lead, Canada in a Century of Change. The lecture continues, so please enjoy.
On the economic front, it is very important to recognize that when we are looking at a stable world and a growing world, there is a rapid transition now of countries that were not very long ago quite poor, who are becoming at the least less poor, and in some cases emerging. That happens in improbable places, which is a euphemism for Africa. Some of you will know that of the 10 fastest growing nations in the world in the last couple of years, six are from Africa. The rates of growth are fastest there. There are reasons for that. Some of them are resource related, some are not. But Africa for a long time was ignored or did not have proper priority in the investment plans of private sectors or Western nations. In that period, while other countries might not have been present, Canada was. We built up a very substantial reputational asset. And now, in an age when there is more interest in commercial relationships, those assets, the fact that we are known, the fact that we have been trusted, the fact that our missionaries were there long ago, the fact that many of the leaders, for better and for worse, were taught by Canadian teachers, that is an asset commercially. And in a world where the commercial status of countries is changing, where the capacity to be part of the future, where that is happening, we, if we are going to follow a policy that includes commercial expansion, commercial diplomacy, I think is the phrase, if we're going to do that, we cannot blind our eye to the capacity of the developing world. And again, we have assets there that are important. I think that those assets that Canada has enjoyed for some time have been put in danger now. They're not over, but they are at risk now because we have been pulling back from development. We are focusing so narrowly now on economic or on military matters. I now want to come to a part of of a discussion that I hope will be participatory and joint. The real question is, if we have these, there are two questions. One, will the government suddenly be persuaded by my book, by my book, and change its policy? Not on your life, will that happen? But is that the end of the story? Or is there something that citizens can do? Is there something that those of us who believe in some of these issues can do that will make a difference? And let me just say something about who is active internationally in Canada. We tend to think of international behavior in terms of the diplomats who go forward or the soldiers who go forward and represent Canada in the world. Think of this. Think of the response of Canadians to the crisis in Philippines. And think back to the many, many times that has happened when international crisis arises. And ask yourself the question, if Canadians will respond to a crisis, why can they not be engaged in preventing that crisis from occurring? That's a kind of airy fairy question, but it has, if we look at it seriously, I think some practical consequences if we look at how that might be done. Again, in terms of who's active in the world, Rotary is active in the world. The Kinsmen are active in the world. All sorts of service clubs. I was in Grand Prairie 14 months ago to speak to a Rotary district meeting. And as some of you will know, there is not a multitude of flights into and out of Grand Prairie. So when you go in, you're there for a little while. And I looked around the exhibit of the activities of Rotary, of this district of Rotary, in the developing world. And I remind you, this is not simply sophisticated Edmonton or Calgary. These are the rural towns that I used to represent in the House of Commons. They are doing extraordinary things in the developing world. The same is the case with other service organizations. I've talked before about the impact of faith groups and of the large numbers of Canadians who were involved in supporting one way or another non-state organizations. If we look at, and the point that I almost forgot to make, that is perhaps the most important, we are international because we come from the world and we remain intimately connected with the world. It is not inconsistent with Canadian identity or loyalty to retain strong connections to and interest in the places from which you come. So that gives us a wide range of access to influence and to activity in the larger world. What can we do with this? How do we mobilize this? There are two or three things I suggest in the book. One is that we should be working much more with non-state actors. We should take the example either of the anti-apartheid campaign. I'm sorry, I give this speech from time to time. And I never forget what I said, but I sometimes forget where I said it. When we were dealing with apartheid in South Africa, one of our challenges was to have a presence on the ground that went beyond the immediate reach of our very skilled diplomats. And I would say the most important single relation we developed as a government of Canada was with the Canadian Labour Congress. And as Jim Edwards will recall, the relations between the Mulroney government and the Canadian Labour Congress were not the most fulsome or mutually respectful. And yet, because we had an interest in common, we were able to liaise with the CLC, which had its own networks with COSATU, the Conference of South African Trade Unions. And that meant that we had a means to have a presence on the ground, not only to hear what was going on in fact in local communities across South Africa, but also as a means of getting information out about what the wider world was doing and saying about that regime. It was a very important thing. So we've done that in South Africa on apartheid. We've done that with landmines. Ask yourselves the question, what is the next landmines issue? Where is there another issue where civil society has brought a question not quite to the boiling point, but to a point where there is a need for action? And yet it is number 3 or 4 or 19 on the normal priority list of governments. Where can we apply this principle? What issues in the world are susceptible to that? A second area where I think we have to focus real attention is on reviving the relevance and the performance and the effectiveness of multilateral organizations. There tends to be a sort of a black and white view about the United Nations. Is it efficient? Is it inefficient? Of course it's inefficient. Of course it is a difficult place to work. And of course it is invaluable. And of course it can be improved. And surely it is an institution, one among many, where we should be using our talents and our reputation to move things forward. Not just the UN. We should not be absent from Commonwealth conferences. And indeed, we should be in the foreground of trying to determine how an organization which is so internationally representative and has such a capacity for influence can be renewed in modern times. It's an old-fashioned organization. Louis Saint-Laurent undertook one major change from empire to Commonwealth. What can we do to identify a major change from the old Commonwealth to this new world? Surely there are opportunities. Think of small states. People interested in climate change, we worry about what might happen to Canada in 10, 15 years. If you're in a small state, you worry about how far you'll sink tomorrow and how fatal that will be, and nobody listens to you. Not even in the Commonwealth do they listen very much. We should be doing that. That's unfair to the Commonwealth. There are study groups and things on it, but it's not a priority action. What could we do as Canadians to reinvigorate that organization? Et c'est la même chose avec la francophonie. Nous avons maintenant une position au sein de la francophonie qui est importante, mais nous devons l'utiliser pour le renforcer. And there are a number of other organizations where we have that kind of capacity. And the third notion in my book, on which I need some help, is that it comes from the following. After helping shape a new world after the Second War, we formed alliances with a number of countries with whom we had common interests. Those alliances were fairly formal. One was the North Atlantic Treaty Organization with Europe, principally with Europe. Others were the World Trade Organizations. I'm not now talking about formal alliances, but should we not be looking around the world at other countries who share some of our qualities now, who are good at managing diversity, who have earned trust, who are innovative in public policy? And should we not create a little list of 10 or 14, and just make a point of meeting with them 4 or 5 times a year to see what we have in common? That would be the purpose of the meeting. It would not be incidental to our discussion about something else. And if we were to do that, I'd welcome debate as to whether that's useful. If we were to do that, who might some of those countries be? Well, obviously, the Nordics would be among those countries. Norway has continued the practice that Canada began and so have other Nordics without capacity. Switzerland would be. Australia is a country, we have not made enough of our relation with Australia, I think, and there is more to make of it. Indonesia would be a fascinating ally for Canada. A large, large country, formerly one of the founding members and driving forces of the Non-Aligned Movement, the organization of countries that would not be with the Soviet Union and would not be with the West. Indonesia has been reforming itself quite successfully internally, not perfectly, but a significant move forward. It is interested in these international events. It's hosting meetings and conferences that it did not before. And it is home to the largest Muslim population in the world. Surely an asset in a time when the question of relation between Muslims and non-Muslims is such a critical factor. Ghana. I have a lot to do with Ghana. And Ghana is a country that has had more than its share of military takeovers and changes. But its last three elections, free elections, power has changed party to party by the narrowest of margins every time. The last time, the election in January of this year, was so close that it was challenged in the Supreme Court of Ghana. The hearing took 8 months. It was broadcast in entirety on Ghanaian radio, and Ghanaians, for all of those 8 months, from dawn till dusk, the court didn't sit that long, from when the court sat in the morning to when the court rose in the afternoon, listened to the proceedings. Can you imagine a commitment to democracy in Canada like that? But it happened in Ghana. It happened in the country where governed in the continent where governance is supposed to be difficult. We should be looking at what we have in common with Ghana. Korea. We regard Korea properly as an economic powerhouse, and it is, and it has its challenges. But Korea has also taken a renewed interest in reforming the idea of what international development should look like in this changing world. It hosted the last international OECD meeting on this subject. It's interested in improving its status on some of these issues. Turkey, a country that with whom we've been associated for a long time, which has links that literally no one else has to powerful countries that were formerly part of the Soviet Union, that does not seem to be overwhelmingly wanted by its immediate neighbor, Europe. Why should we not look to see what common interests we may have with Turkey? And what might be made of that? Mexico, our NAFTA partner, soon to be an economy larger than our own, a portal to Latin America. Why should we not be looking at broadening the cooperation with Mexico? In fact, I have some experience with that because one of the strengths of Canadian policy in the 1980s was that we were able to make a significant difference in Central America. In fact, the current Lieutenant Governor of Alberta led the UN forces. The peacekeeping forces. They were approved by the UN. They were appointed by the countries of Central America. And we did that because the Mexicans invited me as the foreign minister to come to conferences to which Canada had not been invited before. And we went. And we found roles that we could play. I'd be interested in which of those names on that list are off the wall. I'd be interested in knowing what other countries you think might be included. I'd be interested in knowing if you think the idea is bonkers. Last point. One of the reasons I wrote this book is because my view of Canada is that, I've got to be careful how I say this, we are not a natural country. We're not an island. We're not surrounded by mountains that keep everybody else out. We have had to build this country. And most of the things that we have built have been as the result of national conversations. We live apart from one another. Nous parlons français, we speak English, we allow it, instead of being an instrument of communication sometimes, to be a barrier between us. We have all these differences. And yet, we've been able to come together in national conversations, sometimes through the form of royal commissions. Royal commissions are worth looking at. We have an equalization program because it was proposed by a royal commission. We have a national Medicare program because it was proposed by a royal commission. We have the Canada Council and other national cultural institutions because they were proposed by a royal commission. We have a free trade agreement because the ground was prepared by the work of a royal commission, and so it goes. So many of the things that have been great accomplishments for Canada started with national conversations of one form or another. And I think we have to start those conversations again. And I believe there is room for that to happen on the question of international policy, precisely not simply because we have a reputation there and a tradition, but because our conduct as individual citizens is, in fact, so international, and our relations are international. And besides, we have the luxury, because we're a relatively wealthy country, to do things, to spend time that other countries don't. When we look at the problems of the world and who can solve them, Canadians have to ask this question: if not us, who? And when you ask that question, you realize that there is a real need for a broad and effective presence. That's the end of my little lecture. I'd welcome comments, observations, if we have time, questions. Thank you very much for your attention.
And now, we present CJSR News Director Matt Hirji's conversation with Joe Clark. Please enjoy.
Mr. Clark, thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you very much.
To begin, I want to start by being a little bit reflexive. In your newest book, How We Lead, you start by asking a sort of rhetorical question: to what do we aspire? Mr. Clark, in your opinion and in your experiences, to what do Canadians aspire to be today?
I think most Canadians aspire to success in their own lives, which they define in different ways. Obviously, for many people, material success, call it survival, or in Canada, survival plus, is important. I think there's a very interesting dimension among the large population of Canadians who come here from elsewhere, because they are particularly concerned about ensuring that their children have opportunities here that they did not have themselves. I learned that as a member of parliament, speaking to people from those communities. What is interesting about Canada is our capacity for collective aspiration. And I think one of the differences between ourselves and the United States, and that comparison is inevitable when you live next door to a vibrant superpower like that, is that because they have been a superpower, everyone knows that their country makes an evident difference. And certainly in terms of ventures like moving into space, or indeed initiatives they might take in international policy, there is a broader sense of public opinion on these things. It's not always informed, but it's quite front and center. Being an American is part of almost a personal identity. Being a Canadian is not so assertive, but I think that there is nonetheless an aspiration that is fairly common among Canadians, and that is not to be the exception, as the Americans might aspire to be, but to be the good citizen, whether at home or on a larger scale. That doesn't apply to everyone, but I think it applies to a fairly broad cross-section of Canadians.
Well, how does that then manifest itself in our daily lives?
It has from the very beginning, partly I think because we were, in effect, a pioneer country. Certainly, the first peoples in Canada were very communal in the way they approached things. And to some degree, because we live in a winter country, we have had to rely upon others more than some other countries do. Quite literally, we had to do that. And we went through a long period of time when people would do things together, because that is the only way that each one of them could have some opportunity to move forward. It has taken a very interesting form historically in Canada in our interest in cooperative movements. And they have sprung up literally everywhere. Sometimes they took a political manifestation. We're speaking in Alberta, which had the United Farmers of Alberta government for a long time. There was a clear manifestation of it in Quebec with Les Caisses Populaires. It was the case indigenously across the country. We were a country that, as a matter of public policy, particularly in our early days, used collective capacity to accomplish attributes we could not have done alone. That's how we got Air Canada. That's how we got a national broadcaster. That's how we set up some of the other Crown agencies. And there is a more basic issue, I think. And that has to do with our origins. Our neighbors to the south moved to a new continent to put the old one behind them. We moved to a new continent to apply the values and the traditions of that old continent to a new surrounding. And that means that we have had a sense of connection to others, either other places or other people, that I think has been a defining factor of Canada.
So on the international dimension today, where does Canada place itself?
That's an interesting question because Canadians, if you look at individuals, place themselves very actively at the heart of the action. We're speaking in the immediate aftermath of response to the disasters in the Philippines, where Canadians, as happens time after time after time, are among world leaders in their contribution and their willingness to help. We place ourselves internationally because we come from international. We come from everywhere. And though we're the kind of country where you can be proud of who you are, where you are now, but retain your connection and interest to the places you came from. So the past is not simply the past. There is a way in which it is connected. We've always been a trading country, and increasingly now we're going into areas where Canadian commerce had not gone before, to some degree in Asia, clearly into Africa and elsewhere. And that means we're learning more, and we're learning some of the characteristics that help us in those other countries.
Mr. Clark, is there a discrepancy between where we are, where we're currently placed on the international spectrum, and where we could be or where we aspire to be?
I think there's a discrepancy for two reasons. One is a deliberate policy decision by the current Harper government, and they are giving far more weight to our economic and our military presence than they are to our diplomatic and our developmental presence. And I think we are better off when there is a balance. In effect, we have capacities in all four: economics, military, diplomacy, and development. But we're only playing with half our deck, and we're naturally going to be less efficient and constructive than if we were using all of our resources. But the other thing that is happening is that the modern world is changing, and the kinds of issues that are arising are different from those that characterized either the intensity of the Cold War or even the post-war, post-Second World War period. And I believe that some of those new changes I believe that some of Canada's particular talents and assets are more important in dealing with those new changes than they were even with the old. For example, conflict now is driven increasingly by differences among cultures. Where there is diversity, conflict is easy and very dangerous. Cooperation is not so easy, but essential and possible. And we have been, for a variety of reasons, a country that has demonstrated cooperation among differences. That is because there's a more basic quality, and it is a fundamental respect of differences, which really has been part of Canada for a long time, but is now reflected in many of our laws and practices, including the Bill of Rights that Mr. Diefenbaker introduced and the Charter of Rights that was later introduced by Mr. Trudeau. But those are important and distinguishing qualities of the country that make it more possible for us to be involved with credibility in dealing with issues that might arise from diverse populations and the conflicts that are often natural when people have different faiths or different views or different incomes. We are among the people who, by nature and by experience, can be very constructive in circumstances like that.
In recent years, do you feel like we have deviated from that fundamental respect for difference?
I don't think we have deviated from that respect for difference. I think what has happened is that we have stopped regarding ourselves as a whole community. I look at the action of political parties in the past just as a point of reference to what happens now. The political parties of the days when I was active sought to seek support everywhere in the country. They were genuinely pan-Canadian political parties. The Progressive Conservatives were, the Liberals were, the NDP, under a leader like Ed Broadbent, were definitely trying to do that. And that was partly because there were votes everywhere, or we thought there were. But it was also because that was part of the Canadian duty. And what it did was cause people to learn an immense amount about their country. I learned more about my country from being a member of a national political party as a young man, running into people who I thought were very different from me, but here we were members of the same political family. So there was a determination to try to come together. That's no longer the case. People now look not at the country, but at their base. And the base is of necessity particular, and it is exclusive. And it says there are people we don't want to be part of our political family. And the temptation is, if you're elected that way, when you are governing, you will say, well, we're going to give preference to to the people we know, to the members of our base. Whereas I think there was a greater tendency in the past to try to address the whole community. And the other thing that I argue fairly vigorously in my book is that because we treated ourselves as a whole community, we talked to one another. There were national conversations about important issues, and those have dropped off, whether it's in First Minister's conferences, we haven't had one for a long time, or whether it is in the work of royal commissions. The last one we had was a decade ago, a one-person royal commission. Or whether it is in debate in Parliament, which is increasingly limited. I can recall times when a controversial issue arose, for example, in foreign policy, when there would be a full-scale committee inquiry into these things. In fact, in Central America, where Canada was able to make some important inroads years ago, that was largely because a multi-party committee of parliament made recommendations, which I and the government then followed. We're doing less and less of that. So the sources, the opportunities for conversation are declining. And at the same time, we're becoming once again locked into our view of our place. That happens with a Charter of Values in Quebec. It happens with movements that want to erect firewalls in a province like Alberta. I think that's a lamentable trend because we are a built country. We are a country because our people have wanted us to be one. And in order to be one, we have to be talking with one another, which again is why I'm trying to stimulate a conversation about international policy.
That's it for today's Think. We're grateful that you joined us for Joe Clark's lecture, How We Lead, Canada in a Century of Change, and his chat with Matt Hirji. We'd like to thank Joe Clark and Edmonton City Hall for making this lecture available to us. Today's episode was produced and edited by me, Warren Mulvey. For everyone here at CJSR, broadcasting in Edmonton at 88.5 FM and around the world at cjsr.com, thank you for tuning in.